On this episode of the Fanboy Garage, we begin to unpack our thoughts on the past, present, and future of DC properties in film with DC Focus Part 1, Superman. There's a lot to discuss, so let's open the garage and start unpacking Episode 7. And welcome to the Fanboy Garage. I'm Chris Lasanti, joined, as always, by my co-host, the man who insists that the John Williams Superman theme play every time he walks into a room, Aaron Varola.
Hell yeah, man. Dropping that mic all the time. Love that score. What's going on, people? We are talking about some really cool stuff today. I'm actually really looking forward to this episode. This is going to be a good one.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. We've done six episodes up to this point, not counting this one, obviously, and we have really not touched on anything DC related, and that's hard to imagine considering, you know, aside from Star Wars, the beginnings of our fandom. I think you and I both go all the way back to DC properties.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I would say my very first superhero experience was Superman. You know, he was what was hot in the 80s, and I know that my very first exposure to him was obviously in cinema, and that would be Superman: The Quest for Peace, which I love dearly. Like, I don't care what anybody says about that movie. You can talk about Solar Man and whatever else.
Nuclear Man.
You know, the sort of underlining thematic of nuclear peace and weapons and all that stuff. But I love that movie, man.
Yeah, well, that movie is as 80s as Rocky IV. But,
yeah.
You know, we definitely don't want to start, I don't think, with Superman 4, but let's explain a little bit about what we're doing. So we're going to talk about Superman in this episode. We're calling it DC Focus Superman. And then next episode is going to be Batman, which will be on next week. So we're going to really dig deep into these characters and their history in TV and film and, you know, kind of where our passion sits with the characters and tie it into the current situation with the characters, because, you know, what's ironic as I was thinking about this episode is that there's so much talk right now about studio interference and where the studio sits with these DC properties. And one of the things that has always sort of been inherent to DC properties on film, I think, has been studio interference. I mean, it goes back as far back as, you know, Richard Donner working on what was supposed to be Superman 1 and 2 together,
right,
you know, filming them both simultaneously. And so that's, I guess, where we'll start with Superman is the Richard Donner Superman, which to me is really just an all-time classic. I still hold it up there as one of the great superhero movies of all time. I feel like it's the template that a lot of people should use when telling an origin story. And in fact, you know, Christopher Nolan even admitted that he sort of used it as a template for when he was building Batman Begins, not just the structure, but also the way he cast, you know, big time actors or famous character actors in not so big roles, but he wanted to fill the cast with great actors. And that's something that Richard Donner did in Superman.
Yeah. With Marlon Brando, and there are some interesting tales and legends from that man on that set. But I mean, you know, Superman, the movie, is definitely one of my all-time favorite superhero films ever. I will stop whatever I'm doing to watch that film. I've probably watched it more times than I can count. And the funny thing is it carries so much emotional weight. I mean, you talk about the acting in that film. I still get choked up during certain scenes. And there are certainly moments in that movie where my hair stands up always. Like, have watched it more than 100 times, probably more than 300 times, and I still have the same reaction. It's just a really, really well put together classic film. It's gorgeous.
It really is. It's actually the first movie I ever saw on, well, what was cable TV at the time. We didn't have cable TV in New York City back in the early 80s, but my father had a really good friend who we went to visit out on Long Island, and he had HBO, which was this thing that nobody else had at the time. And we watched Superman, the movie, in his living room, and I'll never forget that, because it was just, it completely just kind of took my breath away. And it just, it really is, it, from the score to the acting, and of course Christopher Reeve, who, you know, was really just perfect for the role, both yeah. Clark Kent and Superman. To me, it doesn't get much better than Richard Donner's Superman.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there are some interesting documentaries and like making of features regarding, you know, sort of the discovery of Christopher Reeve and, you know, him being a Juilliard trained actor and had been in lots of theater, and sort of his size and his commitment to the role. And, you know, sort of some really, really interesting stuff. I mean, when you think of Superman, regardless of, you know, be it Dean Cain or Tom Welling or, you know, Henry Cavill, like the first person that most people are going to think of when they think of Superman is Christopher Reeve. Matter of fact, I'm looking at a VHS cassette tape of Superman 2. Awesome. It's like staring me in the face. But, you know, for me, when I first watched that film, I mean, I fell in love with it. I remember I have so many early memories of putting on a red towel and like jumping off of my furniture when we lived in the Bronx and sort of running amok. And then back then, you know, they had the Super Friends action figures where you'd squeeze his legs and arms would fly up.
Yep.
I can't even remember how many of those I had, because every time one broke, I would beg my parents to get me another one.
Yeah.
So, you know, Superman was it. And you know, going back to that film, as, you know, I became a lover and sort of connoisseur of entertainment and film and all of that, you know, I was like struck when I saw, like, was it Mario Puzo's name on there? I'm like, yeah. The writer of The Godfather wrote Superman?
Yeah, it's like, not something you would connect there automatically.
Yeah. Yeah, but it is definitely, it definitely feels like a Greek classic.
Yes.
When you start off, I mean, just the regality of the film and the opening scenes on Krypton and the music and the score and all of that, man, it's such a beautiful epic. And I love that we don't see him in the Superman costume. I forgot what the time frame is. It may actually be like close to an hour. Maybe is that 40?
It could, yeah. I mean, because you have that whole, I mean, obviously you have the stuff on Krypton first, which isn't that long, you know, and but then when he gets to Earth, I mean, he's in Smallville for, you know, a little while there. I mean, they establish like his powers and obviously the relationship with his adopted parents and then, yeah. you know, obviously they had Jonathan Kent die in the movie, which, you know, plays a pivotal role in the, yeah.
Every time.
So that's a big part of it. And then, I mean, he doesn't, and then it takes a while. Yeah. I mean, finally he goes to Metropolis and we see, you know, older, which is now Christopher Reeve at that point, Clark Kent. But yeah, they don't give you Superman right away.
Yeah. They do that, like, you know, when he discovers the Fortress of Solitude and he's sort of being educated, and then all of a sudden he's just standing there at the podium, and then they do this like really epic flyby, and then snap, boom, you're right in the thick of Metropolis, aka New York City, aka the Daily News building, which is mocked up to look like the Daily Planet, which was a building I worked in for about 6 years, but which was probably the coolest thing working at this place, because I would walk in every morning and see that globe and think, Superman, like, this is the Daily Planet.
Yeah, but I agree. I have that same. That's the image I get in my head when I think of like the Daily Planet, and that's what I kind of always want them to hold to.
Yeah. So it's 48 minutes. I just looked it up while
48 minutes in. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't appear until on screen until 48 minutes into the movie, which is pretty significant. I mean, we also have to remember, the time of movies, I think back then in the 70s, they weren't as long, you know what I mean? And this is a fairly long movie. I mean, we're kind of used to it now because we have these like 2-hour films, you know, be it The Last Jedi or Avengers Infinity War and all of that good stuff. But movies back then were kind of short and sweet and to the point. But this movie had some legs to it in terms of time.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about it, put yourself in the perspective of the time. Imagine going, hey, we're going to make this Superman movie at a time when things like that didn't happen, right? I mean, now, like you said, we expect these big superhero blockbuster movies and we expect them to be long and big and whatever. But, you know, this is what, back in 1978? This thing didn't happen. You know, we didn't have these types of movies. And so we're going to make a Superman movie and it's going to be pretty long. And we're also, by the way, not going to show you Superman for the first 48 minutes of the movie. But I mean, it was really a great fit. And it made it that, you know, it was a very big deal. I mean, he put a lot of attention to the details of that movie. And we talked about the casting earlier. You know, I mean, having people like Ned Beatty, you know, in a small role.
Oh, yeah.
And Glenn Ford, obviously. These are, you know, great kind of character actors, especially of that time. And having them in all these little roles, and that's one of those things that Nolan picked up on and used in Batman Begins. And it really is a great thing, and it gives you credibility. And that was the whole point of Marlon Brando in that movie. I mean, obviously, Brando does not have a huge role in the movie, relative to how much they paid him to be in it. But it was a credibility thing. You know, hey, we have Marlon Brando in the Superman movie, because it's going to be hard to sell this big epic, you know, a movie that's long and we don't see Superman for 48 minutes. Oh, and by the way, Christopher Reeve is the star.
Yeah, and you have no idea who this guy is
right
at all. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think who got top billing? It was Brando, obviously, and then Gene Hackman, right? So you've got Jor-El, who probably has maybe 8 minutes on screen. I'm just estimating there. And Brando, and then you've got Gene Hackman, who doesn't pop up until later on in the movie, almost probably a full hour in, because almost close to an hour,
right?
Because they don't, you know, they kind of do the Metropolis thing and him looking for the job, and then they kind of introduce you to Otis first.
Yes,
right. So I don't know, man. It's a, it was a risk, I'd say, especially given, you know, when, again, going back to some of those documentaries and features about how, you know, how crazy the technology was in terms of trying to get Superman to fly with the wire work, and then some of the early sort of CGI stuff that they were, I guess it was CGI, CGI work that they were doing. So, well, it's actually mostly wire work in front of a screen. So, you know, it's amazing. I mean, and it still holds weight. I mean, it still looks good. To me, it still looks great.
Yeah, I've heard people say in recent years that they don't feel like the movie has aged well. They feel like it's cheesy and corny.
What?
And I just don't what? Agree with that, obviously. I get that there are people out there that want Superman to be brooding and, you know, more godlike, but to me, the Christopher Reeve thing is, Christopher Reeve was perfect in the role, and what he did with Clark Kent, to me is so important, because, you know, some people don't like the fact that he played like the kind of the goofy sort of loser role as Clark Kent, but that was so vital to the disguise, because, you know, to me, it was always hard to believe that people couldn't recognize this guy just because he combed his hair different and put on glasses.
Right.
You know, like, it's still this 6'4", you know, guy. You know, there's not a lot of people that are walking around that look like that. And if you couldn't put those two things together, but what he was able to do with changing his voice subtly, you know, the way his posture, you know, and the way he carried himself, like, that was a crucial part of the disguise. So I have absolutely no problem with the fact that he decided to make that decision. And, you know, that's not a decision that was obvious, because Clark Kent has never really been portrayed as that much of a goof.
Yeah.
You know, in the past.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone had ever watched, you know, the George Reeves Superman, I mean, Clark Kent is a cocky reporter, you know, and the sort of comparison to the confidence in Clark Kent, you know, versus Superman is very similar. They are certainly linked, and you know, the mannerisms that Reeves took, Reeve took in the posture, and you know, to your point about the inflection of the voice, there's that one scene where he feels like he's about to tell Lois his secret identity, and he takes off the glasses and he stands up straight. Yep. And he's like, Lois, and you see the transformation. Yes. In front of you, and then she walks in the door and he like quickly like, you know, scours back into Clark with the shoulders slumped and the you know, I was just thinking, and it's brilliant. Nobody's done it better.
No, and that's how I like to think of my Clark Kent, you know, versus Superman. I mean, you're right. George Reeves, his Clark Kent was basically, I mean, the only difference between Superman and Clark Kent was that, you know, Superman had the costume. You know, Clark Kent had glasses. I mean, he almost, there was no real difference in either way. And that's, like I said, that's more common for the way the two characters are portrayed. But, you know, Christopher Reeve did it that way. And that's how I like to think of those two characters. I love that dichotomy between, you know, his Clark Kent and his Superman, because it does complete the disguise.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, and I'll say it, nobody has done it better. Point blank, you can stack them up. Any actor that's taken on the role of Superman before or after, nobody has done it better than Christopher Reeve. I don't care what anyone says. I will fight you to the death. Because that scene right there encapsulates the sort of... And it's, you know what's funny? I'm sorry. I'm total tangent, but I'm a big fan of Kill Bill. And that monologue from Bill when he's talking about Superman being his all-time favorite superhero, and he talks about Clark Kent being a mockery of the human race. I mean, it's some pretty dark stuff, but he's referring to the Christopher Reeves character, because they're, you know, to your point, in the comics and even in other media, he is a very, you know, Clark Kent is seen as a very confident person. And Christopher Reeve puts his own spin on it. And it's just, I don't know, man, I could talk about this thing all day. It's just so, so good.
Now, this is where though, after Superman 1 or the end of Superman 1, this is where things start to get a little rocky.
Yeah.
And somewhat familiar, I think, for people who followed along with the current wave of what's going on with DC. You know, Richard Donner planned on filming Superman 1 and 2 at the same time. It was supposed to basically be kind of one long story. And the original ending of Superman 2 was actually going to be the ending of Superman 1. What we got is the ending of Superman the movie, where he turns back the world, basically, and undoes all that. That was supposed to be the ending of, like, the whole story, right? That's not how Superman the movie was originally supposed to end, but when they realized that they were going to need that movie to sort of stand on its own, he just took that ending and applied it to Superman the movie and made that one complete film. And then, as we know, he wound up getting removed as director because he had a fallout with the Salkins, who were the producers, and they put in... their guy, Richard Lester, who was basically a comedy director at that point, who had made some movies for them. To finish Superman 2. Now, as a kid watching Superman 2, I always loved Superman 2.
Yeah,
you know, I obviously having no idea of any of that stuff that went on, of, you know, that Donner was removed and Richard Lester, I didn't know any of that. And I just always loved Superman 2, and I always held it up there in classic status as well. And I still do, to be honest with you. But we all know everything that's going on with the need for, or the want for, that some people have for a Zack Snyder cut of Justice League. Well, we did eventually get a Richard Donner cut of Superman 2.
Yeah.
which is kind of interesting. And it's a fascinating watch because in some ways, narratively, I like that version better. But yeah. It's a little hard to watch when there's like all of a sudden test screen footage popping in. And like from a technical standpoint, as far as like it's unfinished. And he did have to utilize some of the Richard Lester footage to complete it because he didn't get to shoot everything he wanted to shoot. So it is an interesting watch and narratively it works really well, although it does have the same exact ending as Superman the movie because he still held to that when he put his cut together, which is a little weird. But I still feel that even the Richard Lester cut of Superman 2 is still a great film. It's just a little different from what it would have been. But I still think that version, the theatrical version, holds up.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we're exactly the same on this one because I loved or still love Superman 2. I, you know, totally oblivious to any of the behind the scenes drama. It wasn't until as I got older and I realized, oh gosh, there's a completely different version of Superman 2. And that, you know, then you get the story, you know, on Donner, and they released the Donner cut, and then I'm like, oh yeah, that was kind of hokey. That always bothered me. I didn't really like the cellophane-esque.
Yeah. Right, the cellophane-esque, you know, does not hold up. That is the one of the elements of the movie that it's like. But to be fair, the cellophane-esque didn't even really make sense to me as a kid.
No, it didn't. It didn't to me either. I was like, Superman doesn't have those powers, and then he like multiplied. And he did some really wonky stuff, and some of the jokes were a little like out there. But I'll tell you what, though, that fight scene between General Zod and Do You Care to Step Outside? Like, what? Oh my God, I'll watch that any day. That's awesome.
It sure is.
It really is. You know, but at the end of the day, it is what it is. And, you know, I agree. I think having seen the Donner cut, and again, I totally agree with you, the narrative is definitely more sound, and the stakes felt a bit more meatier, but the execution, and it was only and to your point, it's because of all of those bits and pieces and, like, you know, test footage and all of that stuff that they threw in there, that I'm kind of like, ugh, was this better off, you know, and did we have to get this, like... You could have just, I don't know, done a box set and thrown in the Donner script, and I think I would have been okay with that. But it was interesting to see. But, you know, again, I'm looking at that VHS again, and, you know, Superman's literally like jumping off the cover there. But it's still a good movie. I do have, you know, it's fun. The thing about that movie that kind of, like, I don't want to say ruined it. For me, not with this movie. It was like what Superman Returns tried to do with it, but we'll get to that in a minute. I don't like the fact that Superman Returns tried to hook itself into Superman 2. And I'll leave it at that, and then we'll talk about it later.
We will, because it actually hooks itself, and this ties into the scene I'm about to mention. It hooks itself into the Donner cut of Superman 2 some ways. Because,
let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, the scene where in the theatrical version, Clark Kent talks to his mother at the Fortress of Solitude.
Right.
And in the Donner cut, it's Marlon Brando.
Right.
And they didn't want to use Brando in the theatrical version of 2 to save money, basically, because they were looking to make that move. They were looking to save because they thought that the production costs had gotten completely out of hand, which is one of the main reasons why Donner was removed, right? The budget was, they thought, was going through the roof. So they removed Brando from that scene, and it changes the scene.
Right.
The scene where Superman gets his powers back in, well, there really isn't one in Superman 2 theatrical cut. He just kind of gets them back. But in the Donner cut, there's a very clear scene between him and Jor-El that shows you exactly how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that ties into Superman Returns.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
But then didn't they use some of that footage from Superman 2 that was... So if the Donner cut didn't exist, and they used the Lester cut. Didn't they use some of that old Brando footage in Superman Returns
they
as
did.
Well?
Yeah, they did. That's what I mean. So that's why in some ways, like, and until I had seen the Donner cut, that scene didn't resonate with me as much. And then when I saw the Donner cut, I was like, oh, well, yeah, I wish everybody could see this because one, first of all, it's a better version of that scene, but also now it makes a heck of a lot more sense in the context of Superman Returns.
Yeah. That's the stuff I can't stand about the Superman Returns. And for all of you people who are listening, who have not seen either of those movies, please go out and watch them and do yourself a favor and try to watch those movies back to back and see if it makes any sense. Cause it doesn't to me at all.
Well, we'll get into Superman Returns in more depth in a second, but now we have to get into, well, let's talk more about Superman 2 first, because we didn't even mention what I think makes that movie so endearing, which is, of course, Terrence Stamp as General Zod.
Perfect.
Just amazing, right?
Perfect, yeah. I mean, we get a little tease of him in Superman the movie, and, you know, from the moment you see this guy's face, I mean, he's pasty AF, and he just the sort of scream that he like launches at Jor-El, like, you will bow down before me, is like fearsome. That's like scary stuff. And then all of a sudden he gets released, and the guy commanded every scene that he was in, you know, even in the Lester cut where he's like kind of hokey, he's still great. I mean, and if there is, I mean, I think Michael Shannon did a decent enough job as Zod in Man of Steel, but he had some big shoes to fill, man. Because Terrence Stamp, he brought the pain and all of those the fight scenes and stuff. I know I mentioned it before, but you know, he definitely had a menacing presence about him, you know, throughout the course of the movie, and you know, I thought he did an amazing job.
He really did, and he was a really good like, you just hated him.
Yeah.
You know, and you believed he was a legitimate threat, right, to Superman. I mean, it's hard. People always talk about how hard it is to find villains for Superman because, you know, he's Superman, and who can match up with him, but they could match up with him.
Yeah.
And that was like, wow, wait, this is serious, you know? Oh, and there's three of them, too. So, yeah, I mean, that was really, you know, his Zod is still, to me, that's the Zod that I think of when I think of General Zod. That's the gold standard for me still.
Yeah, yeah. Nah, he's definitely great. And it's funny because at the end, you really do feel like, you know, Superman is giving it up for Lois. You know, he's kneeling before Zod, and then they do that awesome, you know, breaks his hand. You know, crunches his fist up into pebbles and sand. All the bones in his hand just melt away, and he picks them up and he launches them across the room. It's like awesome stuff. And he killed them. He killed all three of them. All of them. He didn't try to save them.
He did. And
just want to say that.
When he crushes Zod's hand, you know, if you don't jump off the couch and go, like, you know, just
you
start pumping. Yeah, I don't. You're just out of it. I don't know what
Something
you're missing. And the music kicks in, and that's just such great stuff.
It is. It is. But you know what's not great? Parts of Superman 3.
Well, parts of Superman 3.
So most of Superman 3 is a turd
now,
fest.
Yeah, now we get to the part where the wheels completely come off. So Superman...
I was going to say, before we get into this is what happens. This is a classic example of you milking the crap out of a good thing until every last drop of its essence and soul has been wasted and thrown down the drain. I'll leave it at that. Superman 3.
So Superman 3 is fully a Richard Lester film. He directed it from beginning to end with the blessing of the Salkins, and... I got to be honest with you. I actually don't hate Superman 3 as much as some people do. I feel like as I've seen it more and more, like as I've gotten older, I find it very watchable still. Aside from the opening title sequence, which is one of the worst things in the history of superhero cinema ever. Okay. It's it's an opening that's more befitting of like a Zucker Abrams and Zucker film, like Airplane or The Naked Gun, you know, where just, I mean, people are falling down potholes and it's just stupid. It's the most slapstick comedy thing you're ever going to see in a superhero movie. And it's so out of place. But after that, I actually find that movie to be very watchable. Now, it's not a great film, obviously, but there are things about it that I liked. I actually don't hate Richard Pryor in that movie. You know, I know it was more of an opportunistic thing and he was, you know, big at the time and it he doesn't quite fit, but I don't hate his role in that movie. I don't love the villains that much, but I do like Annette O'Toole. I've always kind of had a crush on her, to be honest with you.
You're a redhead man.
I did. I always liked her and I liked the chemistry that they had together, you know, in the beginning. And, you know, so Superman, and of course the fight, Superman versus Superman, is great.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So,
and like boozing, doesn't give a crap, Superman, like flicking pistachios at bottles in a bar. Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah. I mean, so that's some really good stuff. And the end is a little, you know, not a little, it's very hokey. But yeah, I find Superman 3 to be, again, it, you know, from a just the quality of the filmmaking, obviously, is not there. The effects aren't as good.
Yeah, although, the plot's a little.
Yeah, compared to the next entry, the effects, you know, look like the greatest thing ever. But it's not that bad of a film. It's a weird entry in a series because it does sort of come out of nowhere. And it is following Superman 1 and 2. So you're like, wait a minute, what were you guys thinking? But overall, in the context of everything, watching it, I think Superman 3 is much more watchable and sort of enjoyable than a lot of people may even remember it being, because it's sort of become the butt of a joke now, right? Like, oh, the Richard Pryor one, you know, and everyone kind of thinks that it's probably just this big comedy, goofy thing. And once you get past that bad opening, it's really not that bad.
Yeah. And they try to do some interesting stuff, too, because in the comic book lore, and they do explore this a bit in Smallville. They talk about the various kinds of kryptonite there are, like red kryptonite and black kryptonite and white kryptonite. And everyone's so used to green kryptonite. But, you know, I think there's also blue kryptonite. A lot of people don't know that there's different variations of it. So they try to do it. Basically, Richard Pryor is, for those of you who haven't seen him, but Richard Pryor's character tries to manufacture kryptonite to stop Superman, and that is what essentially causes him to split, which is something similar to red kryptonite? It might be red or blue kryptonite. I don't remember. So many damn kryptonites. But it's likened to another kind of kryptonite in the comic books. But, you know, I think you and I like, of course, we like the same things about Superman 3. I agree that the villains were like hella weird. Another rich tycoon kind of dude and his like weird scientist, I don't know, girlfriend or not girlfriend. No, not girlfriend.
It was his sister, right?
Sister. Yeah. Yes. I think the reason why I have such like mixed emotions is because if I'm being super honest here, it scared the crap out of me.
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. When she becomes or gets whatever happens to her with that.
Yeah.
That terrified me.
Like scarred me, man, for life. Like,
I'm with you.
Yeah. It and you know what the thing is? Like back then, I think they would do it like in stop motion.
They probably did, yeah.
Yeah, so it has this like really creepy feel to it, like very similar to Poltergeist. And you know what did it recently was It. The new It movie did the same thing with the hair, like kind of going around this girl's face. It's like the stringy stuff.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, that just creeped the hell out of me.
It is creepy. And, you know, I think, and I've read this, and I don't know how true it is, but the original idea was supposed to be for that to be Brainiac, but they just couldn't afford it, or they didn't feel like, whatever, didn't spend in the money, or so they just, it became whatever that computer robot like thing was.
A mechanic bride of Frankenstein. Yeah. I don't know, because her hair is like sticking out of the bionic body. Who the hell knows what the hell's going on?
And you know, the stuff with Richard Pryor in the beginning, like when he first gets the job, where he pulls off the heist that is right. so lovingly replicated in Office Space, where he robs the company of the money using the little rounded off fractions right. of a penny. I really enjoy that stuff. It just, it seems like it's from a different movie, though. Like, it's weird. It's like if you watch that, you don't have any idea that you're watching a Superman movie.
And the other interesting thing about this movie that I kind of wish they explored is you get to see a second version of Clark Kent. You get to see Smallville Clark.
You do.
Smallville
right.
Clark isn't as bumbling and as dumb as Metropolis Clark is.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple moments like where he's sort of dancing and then the music stops and like he's still dancing like a goof. But it's not, you're right, he's not nearly as, and I guess because he doesn't feel like he has to hide as much when he's there.
Right, he's still just like farm boy Clark, right. I guess.
Because Smallville doesn't really know Superman. I mean, everybody right. probably knows Superman, but they haven't dealt with him on an intimate level like Metropolis has, at least at that point, they haven't.
Yeah, and the actor that plays I forgot the guy's name, that sort of high school bully guy.
Right. Yeah. Who's jealous because Clark's hitting it off with
with his ex girlfriend or whatever, his ex wife or what, I don't even remember. The reason why I love that guy is because he's in Willow.
That's the sole reason.
Yeah, so dude. I think he's in Willow. I think I forgot who he plays in Willow. He's the guy with like blonde hair, and he's got this like I don't know. Let me stop there. Well, we'll talk about Willow some other time. But
his name is Gavin O'Herlihy.
Is this the same guy? I could be making this whole thing up right now.
He played Brad Wilson, which was Lana's former boyfriend. Let's see if he was in fact. Oh, he actually was. This is really deep trivia stuff here. He was Chuck Cunningham on Happy Days, the brother that wound up like never existing after like that first season of Happy Days. He was in Death Wish 3. He was in addition to Superman 3. So he apparently liked to be.
He loves those trilogies.
He was in Willow. Yes,
he was in Willow.
Yes, he was.
Yes, what was his name in Willow?
I don't even really know how to pronounce it. Eric Thalberg?
Eric Thalberg? That's what it was. Yeah, it's a Val Kilmer's friend.
Okay.
Yeah, Matt Mardigan's friend. So he finds him in the crow's nest and he tries to get him to come out and he's like, come on. He's like, let me out. And he's like, no, you stay in there and rot.
So there you go. Where else but the Fanboy Garage are you going to get a deep analysis of the career of Gavin O'Herlihy?
Literally, we're sitting here unpacking Superman and we stumble upon this awesome little package called Willow, which we will put on the shelf for another time. But because it's an awesome movie and we should totally talk about Willow. You heard it here first. A Willow episode coming up. But yeah, so anyway, I digress. Superman 3. Could have been better.
Definitely could have been better. Yeah.
Could have been a lot better. But do you want to take Superman 4? Because this one, I will gush about this film for no reason other than because it was my first exposure to Superman.
So Superman 4, The Quest for Peace, which was, now just to give a little bit of the backstory on the movie, at this point, the rights to Superman were sold to Canon Films or Canon Pictures, which was the Golden Globus studio that was famous for making sort of exploitation films. You know, they did like the Death Wish movies and just, you know, usually making movies on the cheap. And they somehow got the rights to Superman. And they made very much so a Canon Pictures Superman film. Christopher Reeve was convinced to do it because he believed he wanted to make this movie about, you know, ending the nuclear crisis.
Right.
And that was an important thing to him politically. So that's why he agreed to make the movie. Why Gene Hackman agreed to make the movie, I have no idea. I could probably find out. Maybe somebody had pictures. Maybe they just offered him a ton of money. I can't imagine that Canon Pictures offered anybody a ton of money. Maybe it was a contract thing. I don't know how they got Gene Hackman to be in that, considering he didn't want to be in the reshoots for Superman 2 out of respect for Richard Donner. Mm-hmm. But he did somehow wind up in Superman 4, reprising his role as Lex Luthor. The villain is Nuclear Man, who, to my knowledge,
freaking
did not,
awesome.
Did not exist, right? prior. He was an original creation. I'm not sure who he was probably originally supposed to be, but Superman 4 is a movie that I, of course, did see in theaters. And as a kid watching it in theaters, I was just excited that I was watching a Superman movie, and I didn't identify that as being a bad film on my very first viewing in the theater. It wasn't until I got a little older and started to watch back that I was like, wow, like this movie looks terrible. Like, the special effects are awful. The flying scenes, I mean, they might as well have just left the green screen up.
Yeah.
Not even bothered putting anything over it, because you could tell it's a green screen, even if you didn't even know what a green screen was. So the effects are really bad. You know, what Donner had mastered so well, and what Richard Lester was even able to somewhat replicate, these guys just could not at all come close to replicating those effects. And there's a plot with Mariel Hemingway and Margot Kidder, who's Lois Lane. Mariel Hemingway's father, I guess, buys the Daily Planet. Was that the thing? And there's competition there, and there's jealousy, because Mariel Hemingway actually, I believe, likes Clark, right?
Yeah.
And Lois obviously is with Superman, and that's like a whole thing. It's like a triangle or whatever it is.
Yeah, there's a really fun scene where he's like jumping back and forth between two dates, you know, transforming into Clark and transforming back to Superman so he can ping pong between his two hoes.
That's not on the box for the VHS.
You like
okay,
that?
Yeah.
Rewrite that sumbitch.
There you go. That would have been probably a more interesting take, I think, than what we got. But
a pimp.
Yeah, so it's basically a very cheaply made Superman film. It was made for, I think, $4.73. And most of that probably went to Gene Hackman. John Cryer is also in it as, was his nephew?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. He's basically takes on the Otis role, essentially, like the goofy sidekick.
He's like really smart, though.
He is, yeah. Otis was a buffoon, but yeah, he's really like a smart.
Mr. Luthor.
Yeah. And then, of course, like your hero, Nuclear Man, with his nails and his flowing blonde locks.
And he had some, like, he had a gnarly voice.
He
had such an, and then, like, I might be making this up. It's probably because the actor didn't speak a lick of English. He's probably from like Sweden or something like that. They're like, hey, you're blonde. You look good. You're pretty buff. You want to be Solar Man? Okay. But I think the saddest part of that movie is that Christopher Reeves does not really look like a fit Superman anymore. He's like thrown away the lifting and all of that stuff. Even though it's like an interesting sequence in the movie with him, you know, pumping iron or whatever, Christopher Reeve just looks tired, man. And his hair isn't really slicked as pristine as it used to be. And Solar Man or whatever.
Nuclear Man.
He
gets his power from the sun, but he's Nuclear Man, though. Yeah.
Nuclear Man is like huge compared to Chris Reeves. It's like, at this point, he's probably aging himself out of the role, and he just didn't want to spend as much time in the gym, and it is noticeable to me. Like, of course, when you're a kid, you don't see that, because you just see the, you know, the blue tights and the red underoos, and you're like, okay, yeah, this is Superman, because he just looks like Superman. But as you get older, you're like, yeah, dude, you should have thrown in the towel after three.
Yeah, I mean, people forget, Christopher Reeve was a big guy, you know?
Yeah, tall and skinny.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching all of the movies, actually. They had a marathon on TV a couple of months ago, and they were doing them, like, in reverse order, so they went four all the way down to one. And I was watching them, and, you know, when you watch him in Superman 1 and 2, like, he's big. I mean, he's not ripped like Henry Cavill, right? Because it just wasn't, like, really a thing back then. But he's a big guy. You know, like, he's not a, like a string bean, like you would, you know, like I think some people have in their mind that he was just like skinny or whatever, but he's not. Like, he's filled out.
Yeah,
Superman 4, though.
Yeah, he was before he took the role. Matter of fact, like one of the features I watched recently was him working out for the role and the amount of weight that he had to put on. He trained with David Prowse, the bodybuilder that plays Darth Vader.
Yep.
worked out with that guy for a significant period of time. So, Superman 1 and 2, I mean, his traps are huge. I mean, his neck raises up out of that costume and he looks amazing. He's so stoic. And then by, I guess Superman 3, he's probably maybe not as defined, or I don't want to say defined, maybe not as thick as he was in Superman 1 and 2. And then by Superman 4, it just looks like an old dude in a suit. Like a leotard.
Yeah, and don't forget, since Superman 1 and 2 were essentially filming kind of at the same time, obviously he was going to have a similar look, right? Because he would, maintain the same regimen and whatnot.
But like I said, all of that aside, John Cryer, Nuclear Man, wimpy, skimpy Superman, long nails and blonde, feathered mullet. Love it. Love it all. I don't even care. You know what I mean? The thing that sticks out to me too, and I was like, this thing made me go to museums all the time. I swore to God that one day I would find a strand of Superman's hair holding 1,000 metric tons, because they got something like that in the scene in the movie, right? Yeah. Do you remember this?
No.
So. This is how they create Nuclear Man.
Oh, actually, yes, I do. Yeah. That's correct. Wow. Some of the things you put out of your mind, even though it hasn't been that long since you've seen the movie.
No, I mean, I haven't watched that movie in forever.
Oh, I watched it. Well, I didn't watch it all, but I watched most of it a couple of months ago and didn't even remember that.
Man, yeah, dude, that thing stuck with me.
I mean, you're obviously passionate about this film. I watch it, from a different perspective, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, but hey, different strokes for different folks, and that essentially put the nail in the coffin for Chris Reeves as Superman, because that was not, even for that time period, it did not do well in the theaters, and that was the last time we saw Superman until TV show. Well, they had a Superboy show.
They did, but before we get into some of these other little kind of sub things, just for your reference, since we're big on the trivia here this week on the Fanboy Garage, the man who played Nuclear Man's name was Mark Pillow, spelled just like the thing you lay your head on at night. And he,
because his head had feathers, feathered hair.
You're big on, let me tell you something. So this movie we probably should have talked about in the action movie episode, because you're big on the feathery blonde hair 80s thing. But he did not go on, shockingly, from what it looks like. I don't think he had done anything before or after, because he doesn't have a filmography or anything. Is that true? Is that a fact? Do we know that?
I have no idea.
Oh.
I am totally. Well,
we're just going to go with that story. Okay.
Yeah.
And the direct...
Nothing on where he was and where he came from?
No, there's not a Wikipedia entry for him. It's the only thing involving Superman 2 that does not have a Wikipedia sub-entry is the career of Mark Pillow.
But started and killed his career all at the same stroke.
Yes, and Sidney J. Fury, who was the director, he directed Iron Eagle.
Oh,
and
okay.
Iron Eagle 2.
All right.
They bookended Superman 4. So one, he made Iron Eagle right before and Iron Eagle 2 right after. And also Ladybugs with Rodney Dangerfield. That's the soccer movie, I think.
Oh, man.
Yeah, with Jonathan Brandis, where he...
That's a sad story.
That movie is a sad story.
Yeah.
Which I don't think would fly well today, but so yeah, that's him. Maybe. But at least he had a career before and after, unlike Mark Pillow or Gavin O'Herlihy.
There's always Willow.
Yeah. So now you started to mention the Superboy movie. I mean, obviously, in between there, you had the Supergirl movie with Helen Slater. Yeah. That is a mess, although I was a big Helen Slater fan at that point, specifically in that role. But that movie is unwatchable now.
Yeah, I think I've only seen it twice. Once in the... I don't even know if... I may have seen it in the theater.
I definitely saw it in the theater.
And I was pissed as a kid.
Yeah, I would watch Superman 4 any day over Supergirl, because at least Superman 4, there's a sort of that it's so bad you got to watch it type of a thing going on. Supergirl is just brutal.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Yeah. My memories of it are not fond.
And that's still under the Salkin regime. That's before they gave up the rights to the property. But Superboy was a television show that I guess was the return of Superman or a Superman property to TV at the time.
Yeah.
And it was a, I think it was a syndicated show, right? Which some people listening may not even know what that is anymore. But there was a time when you basically just had like your major broadcast networks that were airing original mm-hmm. television, and shows that were on in syndication, first run syndication, were not on broadcast primetime schedules. They were just on like whatever network had picked them up, like independent yeah. channels usually, and usually on weekends and afternoons, like which was when they aired their original programming. And I wasn't a really into that show that much. I don't remember it being particularly great.
Yeah, I think I watched bits and pieces of it, but the same, I don't have really like hardcore memories of it. Just that maybe I did watch it because it was Superman.
Yeah, but what we do have hardcore memories of is the stuff that kind of followed. So Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, which I yeah. feel is one of the underrated Superman versions or stories mm-hmm. out there. That's a show that you don't really hear talked about much, and I think Smallville is a big reason for that. But you know, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, is a show that people may not realize was much more of a Superman show than I think you might think it is based on the title, because it was yeah. originally sold as really more of a Lois and Clark story, obviously. Right. But it is very much a Superman show, especially in the later seasons, where the emphasis, I think, was even more on Superman than on like the Lois and Clark thing.
Yeah, they did some really interesting stuff. I mean, they certainly positioned, Lex Luthor and him were going back and forth, quite frequently with one another throughout the show. And, I've got great, great memories of it. And it even started as sort of like an origin, like a light treading of origin, a material like who made his suit, all of that stuff. So there were some really cool nuggets to the Superman mythology that they included throughout the show. But I've got great, great memories of that. And then they were, it got cut. It was canceled.
Yeah,
right?
Unfortunately, a lot of times, shows like that are, going to be bigger budget shows for television anyway. And again, at the time, if you watch it back now, you're like, really, that was big budget? Because the effects are whatever, they're okay by the standards of television of that day. But yeah, it did. It got canceled. Viewership didn't hold.
It's like four seasons?
It was, yeah. But it did have a really strong cast. John Shea was Lex Luthor, and he's usually really good. And the late Lane Smith, who I think most people probably remember now from My Cousin Vinny. He was the, the lawyer. He was the prosecutor. Was Perry White. And, of course, Dean
Cain. He's also in The Rocketeer.
Yes, he is. And Dean Cain, I always thought Dean Cain was really good as Clark. His Superman was fine, but I thought he was really good as Clark. And I liked Terry Hatcher as Lois Lane.
Yeah, yeah. I thought they were. I thought it was great. I mean, for the times, yeah. It was sort of exactly what we needed.
And I've recently rewatched some of those episodes, and there's just a real nice nostalgic feel to it. And like I said, it is very much a Superman show. So if anybody out there has not ever seen an episode of Lois and Clark, you should go check it out. I think it's getting lost in the shuffle, but it's really definitely worth watching, worth seeing.
And then, let me see, if we're going down the Superman timeline, is it time for Somebody Save Me? That awesome Smallville opening song, which I totally watched while I was in college, like, every freaking week. Like, loved that show. It was corny. Up until season three, maybe, but it was like villain of the week. Like, yes. You had Bug Boy.
Right.
Bug Boy, you had like, I don't know. Actually, Amy Adams is in that show. She was absorbing people's body fat to sustain herself. It's quite interesting. Basically, it was a villain of the week. It was everyone who was affected by some sort of radiation given off by kryptonite. And it was in their food and in their water system. And all of these people were being impacted by the meteor shower. And so good old farm boy Clark Kent was facing off with all of these horrible villains while keeping his secret safe from his love, Lana Lang.
Yeah, now Smallville originally was going to be like a Superman show without Superman, right? The whole original point was like you were never really supposed to see him as Superman.
Yeah.
It was just really going to be like a coming of age story, hence the title. And as it went on, I mean, it went on for 10 seasons, which was probably way longer than they ever thought they were going to get, especially definitely. Not being on a major network. But as the show went on and they needed to, you know, like, well, wait, it can't do 10 seasons of just Clark Kent on Smallville pretending he doesn't have powers. So he started to embrace the powers more and more. And then by like the end, I mean, it was a full fledged superhero show. I mean, you had the Justice League on there.
Yeah.
And I mean,
Green Arrow.
You did. And I mean, it actually became a lot of fun. It started out a little slow. I mean, I know some people like those early seasons because it was more like a personal thing, but it is a little slower.
It was a love. It was like the love story thing. Yeah. It was like boy, you know, boy loves girl, girl's dating somebody else. You know, this dude could be a total, you know, alpha male, but he has to sit in this on the sidelines because he doesn't want his powers to be revealed and blah blah blah. So. I mean, I loved it. I really did. And I've got fond memories of it. Lots of Lifehouse. Lots of Lifehouse. Like literally every episode was like a new Lifehouse song. It's some really interesting stuff on that show.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a product of its time, which is where the Lifehouse thing comes into play. But and especially on that network, you know, it did have those elements to it. But if you stuck with it, it did reward you as a Superman and a comic book fan.
Yeah, and I will say, Michael Rosenblum.
Oh,
Bloom?
Michael Rosenbaum.
Baum, yeah. Amazing Lex Luthor.
The best, like, to me. To me, that is, he is my, I said how I said Terrence Stamp was my gold standard, General Zod. He is my gold standard Lex Luthor.
He is so good. I mean, it's kind of funny because I think that for anybody that is okay with Jesse Eisenberg's take on Lex Luthor,
knows nothing
of Michael Rosenbaum.
No,
like probably has not even been exposed to Smallville and the brilliance in which he played that character, starting off with. Like it's literally a nugget. He's obviously Lex Luthor and he's got serious daddy issues, but his hatred for Superman comes from a very, very real place. And that is a deception and of being lied to for many, many years. I love that.
And he's so fantastic actor. You know, I would say that I consider him not just the best Lex Luthor, but that's one of the great TV villains of all time, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. He's so good.
Yeah.
And again, another recommendation, if you guys haven't seen Smallville, watch it for Michael Rosenbaum. Like, because he's that good. Anytime he's on the screen, he's great. But the show kind of suffers because I think it is season 5. Or maybe it's season 5, if I remember correctly, where he exits the show. He's kind of, is it 5? It may have been 5. He exits the series and then comes back for the final season. Season 10. It's good. You guys should check it out.
Yeah, Smallville is definitely and I think more people listening here have probably seen Smallville than Lois and Clark, but if you haven't, definitely it's available to binge watch I think on Hulu and probably a bunch of the streaming services.
Yeah, it's definitely on Hulu because I think my account just played it randomly. But and then the interesting thing about Smallville is that Smallville ran right smack into the next cinematic version of Superman. I think it was season 7 or so. 2006 when we got Superman Returns.
Yes, we did. So Superman Returns is a movie that I wish was better than it is. There are things in Superman Returns that I really like a lot. I love the look of the movie. I love the fact that it has a timeless quality to it. I love the way Metropolis looks. I like Brandon Routh. I don't like the Superman costume, especially considering it's supposed to be a sequel to Superman right. 2, and it's a completely different outfit. I was never a fan of that look. I do like Brandon Routh, though. I do feel, though, that he was a little young, considering the timeline and what he was supposed to be. But he's really good, and obviously they cast him because of his, you know, kind of the resemblance in the to Christopher Reeve at the time.
Like, creepy.
But, yeah. But, so he's fine. It's the worst Lois Lane ever.
Yep.
She to me, is what Hayden Christensen was for me in the Star Wars prequels. Every time she's on the screen, she brings it to a grinding halt.
That's awesome.
Kate Bosworth, she's bad in the role. It's a poor casting decision. Nothing against her. I mean, you know, it's just was a bad casting move. And she's also young, I think, to be in that role, considering who she's supposed to be as well, if you really look at it as a true follow-up to Superman 2. I'm a big Frank Langella fan, so anytime he's in a movie, I'm okay with it. So I didn't really have a big problem with him, although I wasn't in love with his interpretation of Perry White, but he's a great actor. And, you know, for me, where I tend to differ from a lot of other people is I was not in love with Kevin Spacey's Lex Luthor. I know some people love it. They think he was great. They liked him better than Hackman. He's fine. I just...
Wrong! Sorry. Worst effing line.
Oh, I thought you were saying I was... Oh, his no. thing, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm not... I was not in love with that portrayal of Lex Luthor. I like what they were trying to do, you know, and I like that they were, you know, trying to ignore 3 and 4 and make it a thing, but I almost think that Bryan Singer, he became too infatuated with the idea that he was making a direct follow-up, and he relied too heavily, in some ways, I think, on callbacks to the Donner movie, and I just think didn't put enough into making it a little bit more original, but some of his decisions, I think, from a casting perspective, failed. And although I do love the look of the movie, I wish it was better. I just find that movie to be a bore, which is probably like the worst thing I could say about a Superman movie. Like, there are parts of that movie that just go nowhere. And I didn't love the storyline with the kid.
Dude.
I
hate it.
Yeah, I don't get it. I'm not sure what it was supposed to be building towards. There are amazing Superman stories. Like, there was a current run in the DC Rebirth run of the comic books recently in the Superman title where, you know, it's about Lois and Clark living in solitude, you know, and raising their son. And it's a great story. That story with that kid, it just did nothing for me. I didn't really understand
it. I mean, it kind of comes out of nowhere, man.
Yeah.
It's like
definitely comes out of nowhere.
Isn't he blah, blah, blah. And then he pushes the piano and you're like, what? Yeah. I like all of those things you said in terms of issues with the film. I share them and a lot more. I remember walking out of that theater pissed off, man, like vehemently pissed off. Like, I wanted to kick 5-year-olds in the head. Wow. Like, I was so pissed
off.
That's
pretty pissed, yeah.
Because the thing is, and this is one of those situations where I feel like the promise of nostalgia, when it doesn't live up to expectations, like, it hurts so bad. I watched that trailer probably more times than I can probably remember because of the epic, like, Krypton music, and you see, like, Clark jumping through cornfields and all of that stuff. And, you know, you get that epic shot of the bullet going off and bouncing off of his eyeball. Like, I was like, oh my God, this is, like, so cool. You know, we finally get to see a little bit more tech adding to Superman, and then they started pulling some crazy stuff with, like, Lois has moved on, she had a kid, blah blah blah, which I was like, fine. I was like, okay, obviously he's been gone for a couple of years, totally makes sense. And then I remember, you know, it's funny because because Mario talks a lot about this. The editor-in-chief of Revenge of the Fans talks a lot about kind of revisiting, visiting this blog throughout the production called bluetights.net. And I also used to do that because that's when I was like really, really digging into, you know, kind of the behind the scenes making of films and like kind of keeping up with the latest scoops and all that stuff. You know, that's when I first heard about where this movie fits in the timeline. And then I went back and I rewatched, you know, Superman 2. And then the Donner Cut came out. And I was like, wait a second. This doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
And this is like, and this is when I first realized that I am the king of continuity. So I literally was like, okay, so Superman and Superman 2, and please, people, join me on this ride of nonsense. In Superman 2, Clark gives up his, or Superman gives up his powers to be with Lois, right? They have some sort of love thing.
Relations. They have relations. Yeah.
They have relations.
Super relations.
Super relations. And he, you know, he's essentially human or whatever, what, to be debated. And he gets his powers and she finds out that he's Superman and she, you know, Lois is a wreck at the end of, this is the Lester version, by the way. She's a wreck. He kisses her. She forgets everything. Right?
Yes.
Are you telling me that 5 years later, or however long he's gone, she's pregnant with Superman's kid? Does she? I mean, this is the thing. Does she know that it's Superman's kid?
I always got the impression that she did. Like, and she, I always felt that she did. I mean, the performance is so dull that I never really cared. But I always thought that she did believe that she knew that that was him. Yeah, yeah, that was his son.
But then she doesn't know that Clark is Superman. Like, that's the point where the whole thing like falls apart for me. You know what I mean? So it's like, and then, you know, and then he leaves. So he's like, so Superman's a deadbeat dad, essentially. Slow kid grows up thinking some other dude is his father. It's not Superman. She doesn't tell him. I'm like, these are like the stupidest life decisions in her life. Like, what? Like, Lois, you deserve to get drowned in the ocean by some gnarly crystals. Anyways, that's a lot of hate for one movie. I will pump the brakes, stop there.
Yeah, well, you really have. I just feel like it's a bore. You have a passionate hatred for this movie.
You know what? Ask my buddy, Superman Fan One, because we saw that movie together in the theaters, like what my reaction was when I walked out of that theater.
Is he the one who stopped you from kicking the 5-year-olds?
Dude, I was pissed. I know exactly where I was. I was in New Rochelle at the Regal IMAX theater over there. I walked out of that theater and I was like, what the hell is that movie?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of Superman Returns.
And so bad.
Yeah. It's just, and needless to say, it didn't kind of live up to the hype, which is why we wound up getting another reboot, which leads us into the more current times as the what we now call the DCEU starts to form with Zack Snyder's Man of Steel, which is a movie that I was really excited about because I actually had been a fan of most of Zack Snyder's work at that point. Save for like Sucker Punch and I never saw the Owls movie, but I love his Dawn of the Dead. I think it's one of the best examples of how to remake how to unnecessarily remake a classic. I am a fan of Watchmen. 300, I appreciate. It's never been a story that particularly interested me, but I appreciate, you know, what he accomplished by making it.
The visual effects.
Yes. So I was a fan of his and I was like, wow, this is going to be amazing. That trailer for Man of Steel, I don't remember, probably the first one that came out, I was like, wow, this movie cannot come out fast enough for me. I thought that they were going to hit on everything, and you know, Henry Cavill looked great in the pictures, you know, in the role. Then the movie came out, and I don't hate Man of Steel as much as some people, I think, retroactively do now. I left that theater after Man of Steel. I didn't love the final act, like many people, but I left that theater like, okay, you know what? That was a good movie. There are some things I would have done different, but I think that once we get the sequel, you know, it'll finally kind of bring it all together. The problem is we never got that sequel, the true sequel. And I always feel like the biggest flaw of Man of Steel is not that they had Superman kill Zod or all the destruction. I thought the biggest flaw of Man of Steel was that we never got that true Man of Steel 2 to finally see that cast and that actor in particular, who I still think is great in the role, get to be the true Superman that we should have gotten. You know, Superman, Man of Steel is very much a first contact film. It's very much an origin story where we don't trust him. He doesn't trust us. And I just wish we would have gotten the movie where we all trust each other and we finally see, like, Superman be Superman and Clark Kent be Clark Kent. And we didn't get it. We got BVS instead, which is, I think, derails the whole thing. But Man of Steel itself is good. And Michael Shannon, who's a great actor, despite not, you know, being Terrence Stamp, he's good as Zod. Shannon's great. Yeah. I'm a big fan of his. And I like the whole cast. I like Amy Adams. Obviously, you know, Lawrence Fishburne, he doesn't have a huge role, but he's really good. You know, there's a lot to like. You know, Kevin Costner's good and you know, Diane Lane. So there's a lot to like in Man of Steel. I just, for me, it's always been more about how they followed it up than that movie itself.
Yeah, I, you know, I'm a big Nolan fan, and I know next week we'll touch Batman, but I feel his strokes. That sounds so bad. I can see his broad strokes in the movie, and his sensibilities are woven throughout the film up until you get to the third act, where it kind of becomes a Snyder,
right?
A Zack Snyder sort of CGI porn fest. And I really, really like Man of Steel. I mean, I genuinely do. I think that there were some interesting things that they were doing with the character in terms of deconstructing him a bit and creating a sense of insecurity in terms of, you know, this is what he needs to fulfill in order to become the hero that the world needs. I loved some of that. I mean, the scenes, I'm a big father-son kind of like a person when it comes to seeing that kind of imagery on the screen. So, you know, I know we talked about Superman 1 and the scene with Jonathan Kent. Like, I cry my eyes out every time I see that. The scene, there are episodes in Smallville between Clark and Jonathan that make me bawl my eyes out. And this, you know, no surprise here, but the scenes between Clark and Jonathan Kent in Man of Steel also hit me, you know, in the feels. You know, there's always that, like, you know, can I just be your son? And he's like, you are my son. Like, love that stuff. Like, that's good writing, you know?
And there's some really gorgeous shots too in Man of Steel.
Yeah, it is definitely a beautifully shot movie in terms of the Americana, you know, the farm scenes and just the palette, the color palette of the film, I think is great. But yeah, I mean, there are some bits that I'm just like, really? Is that really where we're going with Superman right now? Like, and this has nothing to do with the Zod killing, because I actually thought that was smart. You know,
it just needed to be followed up, though.
Yeah, no, I wholeheartedly agree. There was just, you know, some of the stuff, and I did get into a debate a couple of months ago with some folks on Twitter about the, you know, him not being heroic enough. And people are like, oh, what are you talking about? He saved all these people. Like, the ends justify the means. And I'm like, I don't know about that. I don't know about that. You know, I did walk out of that movie feeling a little uncomfortable with all of the destruction of Metropolis. I'm like, first of all, how big is that damn city?
Well, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And he's making out with Lois amidst the ashes.
That to me is always going to be awkward. I know there's people that try to justify it. That's the one thing that is like, really? You picked then to finally do that?
Yeah. And then there's like a quip of like, oh, you know what happens after the first kiss? It all goes downhill from here.
Yeah, because who doesn't want to stop and make a joke at that moment? But
honestly, I mean, I think you probably saw some of my my battles. People are like, well, they just went through some emotional, an emotional moment, like they're in love. I'm like, shut up, please. This guy's like about to get his rocks off amidst the ashes of the fallen people in these buildings, including Bruce Wayne's trusted confidant. Hell out of here. Yeah. Anyways, but it's still, you know, Man of Steel is definitely a movie I can still watch. And then
it goes, I mean, so BVS, you know, is a movie that I know we've spoke a lot about before we even started this. You know, to me, it just continued. It picked up with Superman, and you know, the whole flaw from Superman's perspective in that movie is the fact that, you know, in Man of Steel, he didn't trust us. We didn't trust him. And then we fast forward to BVS, and like, they never showed us the part where, like, as Perry White says, America's love or the world's love affair with Superman comes. It's like, well, no, we never got that. You're telling us that it happened, but we never, other than those little imageries, those godlike little worship images that they, we never really got to see the period of time, because they never gave us that Man of Steel sequel where people did fall in love with Superman. He's still in that movie. We don't trust him, and he doesn't trust us. Yeah. And so it's like we jumped from no trust, and then fast forwarded through all the trust, and then went right back to the no trust part.
Right.
And that to me was the biggest failure from Superman's perspective in that movie. You know, some people believe that Superman needs to be more brooding to be relatable. I don't get it. He's an alien with he's the most powerful being in our world. He flies and has a heat vision. How relatable is he ever going to be?
So I agree with that 100%. I mean, look, for those of you that know me in the flesh, I've got a serious case of resting bitch face, okay? I'm like one of the nicest people, and I'm not just saying this because I'm on my own podcast here, but I am one of the nicest people you will ever meet, but people don't know that because my face looks like I'm telling you to go F yourself all the time, okay? Just the way my face is made. Sorry about that. I'm kind of like a Shar Pei. All right. So if the world's greatest superhero is walking around with a scowl on his face, nobody's going to want to talk to him. Nobody's trusting him. Nobody wants to talk to him. So like his solidarity is amplified or his solitude is amplified. So like that's not Superman. I mean, how he's saving people. Okay. You know, everyone's like, oh, he's heroic. Okay. So he's doing heroic things. Right. But does he actually want to be doing those things? It almost looks like it's a burden for him. Like, oh God, these puny little humans. All right. I'll just pluck you guys out of this flooding lake, flooding river. Here, I'll get you out of here. Oh, look, the shuttle exploded. I'll just catch you guys over there and just put you over here. And then I'll go back to brooding.
Yeah,
I see Lois, and then I want to get my rocks off again.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was, and then of course in Justice League, you know, we're almost going to throw Justice League out for now because I mean we got the chin that you know saved Wisconsin, and we got you know, and they tried to kind of rehabilitate the character and kind of get to me the scene with him in the Flash at the end, the post credits thing where they're doing the race, like that's the Superman I want to see. That's the movie I want to see. There was a scene, I think, in one of the trailers for Justice League where, like, Clark and Lois are, like, having a moment. I was like, in the field. That's the scene. That's the Superman movie I need to see. Like, I want to see Cavill and Adams in that Superman movie, and then I'll be very happy. But we haven't gotten it yet, and hopefully we will, because I do believe that there's a great movie and a great story in Henry Cavill as Superman and the rest of that cast.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think he certainly embodies the physicality of Superman. And I just wish we had, you know, they need to make Superman 2 already. Like, seriously, with Cavill, because the guy needs a good shot here at being Superman. I mean, obviously, we caught glimpses of it in Justice League. To your point, totally distracted, not by the chin, but by the lip or the whole face.
Well, the lip. I mean, I say the chin because it was the lip that they were getting rid of, but the whole thing, the thing got distorted.
Bizarre looking. And, you know, I think the biggest disservice that Justice League did to Superman was like the complete swinging of the pendulum in the opposite direction, where he's like, oh, hey guys, let's do this again sometime. Like, dude, what are you guys doing to this character? Like,
yeah, well,
he's either like in a pile of dirt,
yeah,
you know.
Well, that was, I mean, we all know the flaws of Justice League, right?
And yeah, I mean,
yeah,
that's like a separate podcast.
Yeah, it is. And I think just in general, the future of the franchise will be its own kind of how we tie this whole thing up together.
Yeah.
In its own podcast, because we could go on forever about it. But let's wrap up the Superman discussion.
Yeah.
For now. And of course, next episode, we're going to do Batman. So you can follow me at RealCLMighty on Twitter.
Oops, sorry. Cut you off right there. And you can find me at Starting Sith.
And the show is at The Fanboy Garage. Definitely give us a follow and you know, definitely send us questions, comments, feedback, whatever you can. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we will talk to you next time.
Truth, justice, and the American way.